Peter B. Collins, news and comment for Thursday, April 23rd, 2015. Obama apologizes for a drone strike.
But lies and deception, they move in one direction, and then in the end, you lose. Lies and deception.
Reeking of hypocrisy. President Obama went to the press room at the White House today and disclosed that we conducted a drone strike in January, probably in Pakistan, but he didn't actually say that, in which an American hostage was killed, along with an Italian captive. The president says, as Commander-in-Chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations. I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the U.S. government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families. Now, on the face of it, this seems appropriate. But let me identify for you the layers of hypocrisy. Because the president doesn't acknowledge the secrecy of the drone program, doesn't acknowledge that many innocent civilians who are not Americans or an Italian captive have been killed. And while I'm not, you know, just 100% opposed to ever using unmanned aerial drones, the way we have conducted ourselves, pretending that things that are not secret are somehow secret, pretending that these are precision strikes that only occur after we are 100% certain of who we are killing, and that this use of remote control devices that certainly protect Americans is viewed as a kind of barbaric, cowardly approach to warfare by most of the people on the receiving end. And ultimately, I would argue that the use of drones on the widespread basis that Obama has employed is ultimately counterproductive, and will end up being a recruiting tool for the next generation of those who hate the United States and want to do us harm. Now, as an aside, the administration announced that two other Americans who had joined al-Qaeda were also killed in operations in the same region, and one of them is Adam Gadahn, who's kind of notorious. He's appeared in some al-Qaeda videos speaking in English and encouraging Americans to take up jihad. But this is all so deeply offensive because of the selective outrage, the selective apology coming from the president, who had this to say. The United States is a democracy committed to openness in good times and in bad. It is a cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war generally and our fight against terrorists specifically, that mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur. Now, he's willing to acknowledge that because an American and an Italian were killed. But when innocent civilians, women, and children are caught up in the path of a Hellfire missile launched from a Reaper, Raptor, or Predator drone, no such apology, not even an acknowledgement of the mistake, comes from our government. Now, he defended it. He said that the operation that killed the two hostages was conducted fully consistent with the guidelines for such missions in the region. He said that it was conducted after hundreds of hours of surveillance had convinced American officials they were targeting an al-Qaeda compound where no civilians were present, and that capturing those terrorists was not possible. But this underscores the foolishness of our claim that these are precision strikes and that we know who we're hitting. Because we know that so-called signature strikes enabled the president to launch a drone against somebody because of their cell phone metadata. And so when the president issues this apology, more questions are raised than answered. Why did they wait almost 90 days to reveal this? Did this violate our agreement with Pakistan? And they're saying that the strike that killed Gadan was an accident. They didn't know they were targeting him. Again, this just shows that the pretense that all of this is precise and based on actionable intelligence from the ground, that is a big crock of shit. And we'll hear no criticism of the drone program, of the secrecy, of any of the hypocritical issues that I've raised. Nope. The Republicans won't criticize the president on this one. The Democrats will seal their lips as well. It's really tragic. And I, too, deplore the loss of the American and the Italian. But the arrogance of American power is the real reason that they died. And that arrogance is expressed in so many different ways. Well, there's a drone story from Tokyo. Did you hear that a tiny drone was later discovered to be carrying a little container that apparently had traces of radiation? Was landed on the rooftop of the office of the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. Abe wasn't there. He's in Indonesia. And his security team said, you know, we don't go to the roof very often. Somebody was giving a tour to new employees when they discovered this little drone on the roof. It was about 1.7 feet in diameter, had four propellers, carried a camera, and a plastic bottle with the unidentified contents inside. Now, the idea that they put a little radiation in there suggests that this was a message to Shinzo Abe, who reversed the decision of his predecessor to close all the nuclear power plants in Japan after Fukushima. And Abe has been reopening some of them. And this just shows that, once again, American technology has unleashed these unintended consequences. We have led the way in showing the world how to use unmanned aerial toys to deliver devastating military payloads. And the blowback, well, at this point, we can only imagine some of it. In an amazing, lengthy piece in today's New York Times, the trail of money that went into the Clinton Foundation, the trail of money from similar individuals or sources that paid $500,000 speech fees to Bill Clinton, and decisions made by Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State that paralleled the interests of major donors to the Clinton Foundation, which directly contradicted the rule that she self-imposed when she became Secretary of State. Well, I think we have opened a huge can of worms, and I'll mangle the metaphor bank even further. There's a firestorm coming here. Because the pro-Clinton, pro-Hillary forces are going to be throwing up smoke screens and denials and challenges to prove it. But the appearance of serious conflicts of interest is quite clear. Whether there is a quid pro quo that can be proven, we'll give you the money if Hillary does this or that, is another story. But the perceptions shaped by this first article, and there are more to come, because this is based on advances from this new book called Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer. And Schweitzer comes out of the Breitbart wing of the Republican Party. He's been a fellow at the right-wing Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's written some really smarmy books in the past. But the Times and Fox News and one other outlet made what are called exclusive agreements, and I don't understand how three people can share, and three outlets can share a so-called exclusive agreement. At any rate, the Times, you know, acquired the information from Schweitzer and says that they've done their own reporting to substantiate and expand on it. And the public editor of the New York Times today says she's squirming about these announced deals. She says the Times editors confirmed to her they didn't pay money to Rupert Murdoch's HarperCollins publishing firm for the rights to this so-called exclusive. But there are significant issues there. The other thing I'll say before I detail this for you is that I'm hearing a lot of people conflate contributions to the Clinton Foundation with money that became part of the personal wealth of the Clinton family. And I think we need to be very careful about this, because I don't like the Clinton Foundation. I mean, the whole thing, it's a power trip. It's a way to get rich people to hang out with Bill. And while they've done some good, it is mostly a way to aggregate power and influence for the Clinton family. And the idea that they would aggregate that influence and then not use it, well, that flies in the face of what we know about the Clintons. We know too much about them. So I want to caution that I think there are some people who say, well, you know, somebody gave millions to the Clinton Foundation and that goes into the pockets of Bill and Hillary. I doubt that. That's not an issue here. But the commingling of the power and influence that comes from the collection of money at the Clinton Foundation, the FaceTime, all of the attention that these donors get, it is significant. So, what the Times has exposed here is an apparent conflict of interest, because Bill Clinton was raising money at the Clinton Foundation from a Canadian man associated with a company that became Uranium One. And in simple terms, Uranium One is now controlled by Russia. Because the U.S. requires imports of uranium for medical and power plants, not to mention the Department of Energy and the military uses of uranium, allowing Russia to corner the world market on uranium is a dangerous move that threatens the security interests of the United States. So, the man in question, the Canadian, I'm looking for his name in this lengthy article. It runs 12 printed pages. His name is Frank Giustra, G-I-U-S-T-R-A. And he's been active in the uranium resource sector for a long time. And he parlayed a deal for with a company that he controlled, UrAsia, U-R-Asia, which merged with Uranium One back in 2007. And this guy, Giustra, has donated a total of $2.35 million, which, by the way, was not reported by the Clinton Foundation. The money came in while Hillary was Secretary of State, and she flatly said that they wouldn't allow foreign contributions and they would disclose all of the contributions received. They did neither. And that is very clear from the Times reporting today. And so even if they can, they'll get David Brock out there, who once was on the attack machine against the Clintons and now runs the attack machine against the Clinton enemies. And I know David Brock. I have some respect for the work he does. But in the partisan zone, I don't respect him. And we know we're going to hear a lot of very carefully crafted denials. There's not a shred of evidence that Hillary ever influenced decisions made at the State Department in favor of people who donated to the Clinton Foundation or paid $500,000 speaking fees to Bill. But I don't think we need the proof, because the perception alone is sordid and it conflicts directly with the commitments that Mrs. Clinton made when she became Secretary of State. And Giustra has donated a total of $31.3 million over the years to the Clinton Foundation. He's pledged $100 million. And they'll tell us that, you know, these are all separate. Frank Giustra is just a real good Samaritan who wants to share his money. But when Uranium One was purchased by Russian interests, It required the approval of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And guess who is a member of that committee? The Secretary of State. Now, she's not the only one. So it's not as if she was able to just flip a switch and make it all happen. But she was in a pivotal position. And this failure to disclose the contributions is now exposed because the chairman of Uranium One, a man named Telfer, who's a Canadian, well, he filed tax returns that showed how much money his Fernwood Foundation had given to the Clinton Foundation, and those contributions don't show up on the income side of the Clinton Foundation. And these are not $100 checks that got lost. They came in between, there were contributions of $1.3 million, $5.6 million, $600,000, $500,000. You get the picture. And the Clintons will attempt to power through this by just saying that you can't trust the source. This Peter Schweizer guy is doing a hatchet job. But Schweizer has said he's going to do his next hatchet job on Jeb Bush and the Bush family finances. So it's a fascinating piece. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast. I invite you to read the whole thing for yourself so you know what has been reported. And hot on the heels of these disclosures, the Clinton Family Foundation is refiling 5 annual tax returns. Now, that means they're going to amend them to report the contributions that they forgot to report the first time around. And this is, again, significant evidence that the promise that Hillary Clinton made, because many of us had this concern when she was nominated as Secretary of State, what do you do with Bill? He's got this foundation. He's traveling on private jets with all the richest people in the world, trading his influence as a former president for who knows what. And here we see the evidence of the conflicts and compromises that many of us warned about when Obama made the mistake of appointing Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State for the first term. Every day I like to take a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like MSPs, Anna Gordon-Year, Linda Lewis is a recent monthly subscriber, and Scott Bigelow just renewed his annual subscription. Thanks to each and every one of you. And now that I've embarrassed you, I'd like to note that some people's names never get mentioned here. And that may be because you're not a subscriber. So I invite you to join their ranks. I need your support to keep all this going. And I invite you to come over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. There you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get the coveted ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. And Mr. Escobar will be a guest on an upcoming program. I want to take a moment just as a program note for our listeners that every week I make an effort to bring you 2 in-depth interview podcasts. And last week I got some great interviews and put them out. And this week, for whatever reason, I've put out more than 9 or 10 different invitations to people who I think have important comments that I'd like to share with you. And the scheduling just hasn't worked. So I've got Pepe booked for next week. I've got a couple of other things in the pipeline. So please don't become impatient with me. It's just the ebb and flow of when people are available and when I can get them to match my schedule to put together an interview. Well, it's not a surprise. Loretta Lynch has been confirmed by the United States Senate as the next Attorney General, first African-American woman to hold the position following Eric Holder. And while I'm glad to see Holder go, and you're going to hear more about that in a second, as I've said, Loretta Lynch is not going to be much of an improvement. She's an inside player, a former U.S. prosecutor, and I don't expect to see any forbearance coming from her in the war on some drugs. in the resentencing, pardoning, or commutation of those who are rotting away in federal prison under ridiculous drug laws. But the Senate has finally moved forward with the business after delaying her confirmation for 5 months, which is pretty embarrassing. The vote was 56-43, and Ted Cruz, who wants to be your president, he tried to grandstand a little bit, saying that the Republican majority, if it so chose, could defeat this confirmation. He called Ms. Lynch lawless. And it's because she said she supports the president's executive administrative moves on immigration. And the Republicans didn't pick up on Mr. Cruz's invitation. And even Mitch, let's do it one at a time, McConnell, voted to confirm Loretta Lynch. So here it is, Eric Holder, Attorney General, his final stinker. And this one reminds me of the way he stunk up the Justice Department the last time he left, at the end of the Bill Clinton administration, when he had his fingerprints all over the paperwork to pardon the international fugitive and financier Mark Rich. And that was quite a little scandal that came back to haunt him as he was seeking confirmation as Attorney General, nominated by Obama. But here we have more hypocrisy, more examples of who is above the law, and that Eric Holder is always willing to protect a buddy. And the issue here is that David Petraeus, former decorated military leader, then CIA director, who resigned in disgrace after we learned that his biographer had been sleeping with him, and despite denying it to the FBI, we later learned that he shared much classified information with Paula Broadwell to help her with the book about him. And this leak of classified information is similar to other cases like John Kiriakou, who was sentenced to 30 months in prison because he told a reporter the name of a CIA operative whom he did not know was still covert. That reporter never published the information. The individual was not harmed or compromised in any way as a result. But in the gotcha game of Washington politics, John Kiriakou, who was not a friend of Eric Holder's and didn't travel in those circles, he got hammered. David Petraeus walks away with probation, and they really hit him hard. They increased the proposed fine from $60,000 to $100,000. David Petraeus now works for this big buyout firm, KKR. I don't know what his salary is, but it's in the millions. And so to increase the fine by 40 grand, that is just so bogus. And during the sentencing, I'm told that the judge asked prosecutors if this sentence were fair to other individuals. And the quote is from Petraeus lawyers, who said, oh yeah, yeah, it's fair, it's fair. And you'll recall that it was David Petraeus who was CIA director at the time when John Kiriakou accepted that plea agreement for disclosing classified information. And the quote from Petraeus was, oaths do matter. And there are indeed consequences for those who believe they are above the laws that protect our fellow officers and enable American intelligence agencies to operate with the requisite degree of secrecy. Lies, deception, hypocrisy. Hard to take, isn't it? Well, now that I've slimed Eric Holder as he finally exits the so-called Justice Department, there's a little bit of good news for consumers and activists, and the Justice Department had a role in this. As you may know, over the past year, Comcast, the largest cable company and the controlling owner of the NBC networks, they announced a plan to spend $45 billion to take over Time Warner Cable. And in my analysis, what it basically meant was they were buying the Los Angeles cable market because it's the largest market that Comcast doesn't control right now. And so this is good news. I mean, they were getting to be too big. They're already too big. Comcast is essentially a monopoly in most of the markets where it operates. I have Comcast at home, and I hate Comcast. My only other choice is to go to AT&T for video delivered over phone lines, or go to the dish. There is no direct competition in the cable sector in the San Francisco market or most others around the country. So staff lawyers at the Justice Department raised concerns about a week ago, and then over at the Federal Communications Commission, they put the seal of the kiss of death on it today by recommending an informal presentation that the merger be referred to an administrative law judge. That was the maneuver that killed the AT&T and T-Mobile merger a couple of years ago, and it was ultimately effective today. Our friend and colleague Gareth Porter has done it again, scooping the corporate media. As you know, almost every story about the conflict in Yemen plays it out as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Because the Saudis are militarily active with bombing raids, they said they were going to stop, but they haven't. And the threats of a ground invasion. Well, we constantly hear that Iran is supplying weapons and other support to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. But Gareth Porter, in a powerful story that's linked into the show file for today's podcast, notes that the true source of the weapons that the Houthis are using is the government of Yemen and its former strongman leader, who we supplied with massive amounts of arms, Ali Abdullah Saleh. He writes, "The assumption that the Houthis have been looking to Iran to train their troops or supply their need for weapons ignores the most basic facts. The Houthis built up their military from virtually nothing to as many as 100,000 troops today through a series of six wars with Yemeni government troops. And in the process, they've not only become much better trained, but they've acquired a vast pool of arms from Yemen's black market. And not only that, former President Saleh has become a source of arms that have expanded their materiel even further. And so once again, we have weapons that were supplied by the U.S. to what was then a friendly government in Yemen that are now being wielded against our interests and our alleged allies by the Houthis. And this is a scenario that can play out almost all around the world because we're number one in arms sales. And we're just so frickin' oblivious to the idea that when we sell a gun, that gun can be pointed back at us someday. When we sell a missile, that missile can be fired at us or people we wish to protect. It's an ugly descent into hell. And I thank Gareth Porter for bringing us the truth about the misinformation that we've been seeing in the corporate media here. We've got some listeners in Australia, and I want to note for our friends down under a column that I picked up today from Jonathan Holmes at The Age in Australia. And he writes about the recently passed Telecommunications Interception and Access Amendment Act of 2015, which became law 9 days ago. And he says, a record of your electronic communications, who you call or text or email or message, when you do it, and where you are at the time, your location, must now be kept by your service provider for a minimum of 2 years. And more than 20 law enforcement agencies will have access to those records without the need for a warrant. Now, he then quotes one government official, Attorney General George Brandis, who says, oh, this is a good law because it used to be that 85 agencies could handle or access your metadata. but in developments that are chillingly parallel to the United States and our secret FISA court. Holmes notes that Division 4C of the amended law says that if a law enforcement agency wants to search a professional journalist's metadata, it first has to get a journalist information warrant from an issuing authority. Well, the authority should only issue the warrant, the law says, if the public interest outweighs various other public interests. But then they note that in a secret court proceeding, there will be a public interest advocate. And that's an idea that's been floated for the FISA court here, but is seen as too transparent, too extreme. To have a secret advocate in a secret court who makes arguments on behalf of people who are not there and are not allowed to know what's going on their behalf in any way, shape, or form. And then another section of the law, 182A, says that anyone who discloses or uses information about a journalist information warrant, like whether it's been applied for, granted, exists, or doesn't exist, can be sent to prison for 2 years. So, welcome to the American-style police state, to our Australian friends. And I really rue this day. Last week, authorities in the EU charged Google with anti-competitive or antitrust activities in Europe. And they're still in the G's. They've moved from Google to Gazprom. And I don't know if you've seen this Margrethe Vestager on TV, but she is the EU Competition Commissioner. That's her job. She's very articulate and pretty imposing. She said she's investigating Gazprom's sales policies throughout most of EU's Eastern Rim and is focusing on three key issues: whether the company is preventing cross-border flows of gas to other EU nations, charging unfairly high prices, and demanding to keep control of the pipelines in return for gas. She said it all ends up in one: abuse of dominant position. Well, maybe Google and Gazprom will get together and pay huge fines to the EU. That's probably what will happen down the road. And finally today, I don't know how many of you in the United States or elsewhere care about the retired baseball player Barry Bonds. He was a superstar here with the Giants in San Francisco. And, you know, I don't follow sports that much. But I was intrigued when it was exposed that Barry Bonds was using performance-enhancing substances. And at issue was his application of a thing called the Clear. And he got it from a trainer, and he said he didn't know it was a steroid. He thought it was flaxseed oil. And they convicted Barry Bonds not for using the performance-enhancing drugs, but because he was evasive in court testimony before a grand jury about these issues. They asked him a question. He gave what was called a rambling, non-responsive answer. And the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco, in a 10-1 decision, said, evasive. It may not be accurate or full in responding to the question, but is evasive a crime? And whose fault was it that they didn't keep peppering him with questions or follow up until they got the answer to the question they were asking? Well, once again, power, influence, celebrity, and the ability to pay huge legal bills has enabled Barry Bonds to slip out of this, at least for history. But I, for one, know that he didn't earn his trophies and set those home run records honestly. And what it really showed me here in San Francisco is that baseball fans are able to rationalize a great deal when it's their guy who is accused of violating the rules. And it's only baseball, you know, it's just an exhibition, right? It's just a show. It's entertainment. But these guys get paid millions of dollars. And when they don't perform honestly, I think it undermines the credibility of the whole game. But here we saw people rationalize, and I remember once confronting former Mayor Willie Brown about his defense of Barry Bonds and his attack on newspaper reporters who exposed Bonds for what he is. And Willie, he just looked at me like, "Where'd you come from, dude? Don't you get it?" And I guess I don't. And I'm not sure I ever will. But you got what I have given you, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.